Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Porto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Porto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Porto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on KVRF FM in Palmer, Alaska. And make sure you check out any of our podcasts on mushingradio.com. We have all of them that we've aired here at the studio for your listening pleasure. Tonight, we're going to continue our Iditarod Musher series. We've had a couple of weeks off, but I'm so happy to welcome the mushing mortician himself, Scott Jansen, calling in from, I believe he's in Anchorage, Alaska today. Scott, how's it going?
It's going really good. How about you, Robert?
Doing very well. How is the weather downtown?
Well, actually, it's not too bad. I'm up on the mountain, so there's a little bit of snow that the puppies are running around in.
Awesome. So, you know, everybody knows your story. You're probably one of the most unique characters in Iditarod today. And for folks that don't, tell us about that mushing mortician and that persona that you've built for yourself.
Well, I moved to Alaska. My wife did back in 1985, and we moved up here. I was fresh out of mortuary science college at the University of Minnesota. And so this was my first job in funeral service, was working at Evergreen. And I love the outdoors. I've done a lot up here, and there's still so much more to do. But I started sponsoring Paul Gebhardt, oh gosh, probably 17 years ago. I think it was he'd already run the race once. His second year, and just his Minnesota accent, and Debbie and I being from Minnesota, I just decided to chat with him a little bit, and ended up deciding to sponsor him, and then my interest in the race grew from there.
So when did you first step on the back of a dog sled, and what was that experience like for you?
Well, the first time I did, I had four of my own pet huskies, and their names were Thunder and Lightning and Harley and Davidson.
There you go.
I used to play hockey when I was a youngster. And so I started out with the four dogs, first two and then the other two when they grew up. But I'd go down the coastal trail. We lived down by Westchester Lagoon back then. And I would pull me down the coastal trail with my rollerblades on. And then from there, I'm a cross-country skier, and I started ski-joring with them. And then I decided one year when Paul and I were talking around Iditarod time, and I ended up after Iditarod while the race was going on, I went up to Cold Spot up in Fairbanks and bought my own sled. And so my first time was probably, gosh, around 98, I suppose. And then I played with those four dogs and the little sprint sled quite a bit over those couple of years. And then I ended up starting to mush with Paul out of his kennel. And I think one of our first runs, we had 14 dogs each and went 38 miles, and I was hooked immediately. And that was about 12 years ago now.
And like you said, once you're back there in front of all those dogs, it's pretty quick to get hooked. And here you are running Iditarods, pretty much doing that as a full-time job as long with your other job as a funeral director and business owner. It does take up the time, doesn't it?
Well, it definitely does. And, you know, I've said to many people that when you run the Iditarod, you really find out who your true friends are. And surprisingly enough to me, I've got a heck of a lot of true friends. And that's because between work and training, you really don't have any time for people outside of what you're doing in the mushing world. And then, of course, I get back and work at the funeral home, too. And so it's over the last few years, it's the friends become friends/fans and support you all the way through.
Very cool. Last year, 2012, you finished 38th place. Not a bad finish by all circumstances. How do you think you did this year?
Well, I was really happy with how the race went, and I overcame, just like all of us do in the race, but personally, I overcame a few obstacles, which builds my confidence. Like every experience we get training or racing, anything we're doing with the dogs, that experience to come back and And at different times, the need to do something immediately. And as a for instance, I had a broken runner coming down in the Rhone, and I was able to patch together in Rhone. And when I left Rhone, I got up into the Buffalo Tunnels, up off of the glacier. And as I'm racing through there, and I'm sure others have told the same thing, but we're running on dirt basically, and we're flying along. My runner on the front right side was broken right where it meets the snow. So my plastic was basically all that was holding it on the bottom, and a little bit of supports I had. Well, I came into a corner. I tried to make a corner, and I had just checked my GPS, and I was going just under 11 miles an hour. And I came around that corner and caught a burnt-out stump with the front of the sled. And I ended up flipping over the sled, but I had done a complete rookie move, and I didn't have my snow hook lines through the circle in the front of the sled.
Mm.
And I had them, they were running over the top of the sled. How I did it, I don't know. But I ended up, when I hit the stump, the dogs broke the bridle, and I flipped over the handles, landed up behind the sled. And I don't know, you know, I guess it's stories and experiences of different, you know, little trail mishaps training, but I ducked back just in time. And my snow hooks flew past me because, again, they were hooked in front of the sled. And luckily, I caught one of them. And the dogs dragged me down the trail through the Buffalo Tunnels for about 300 yards. And I was able to snag off my snow hook, get the other one around a tree. And I ran back to my sled, and I run a got sled, and it's the sit-down got sled. And I love it. But the sled, where it hooks into the handle just above the sled bag, it tore all that out, and it was just exciting. I remade a bridle out of two tug lines, and then I pieced the rest together when I got to Farewell Lake and repatched up my runner and ended up making it with that destroyed sled all the way to Tocotna, where I had a second sled waiting, but in the meantime that cost me quite a bit of time. And in this year's, I mean, when I got to Unalakleet, the front of the pack was still in Shaktulik.
Right.
And that was the amazing thing. I mean, I only have 2 years' experience in the race, but I've pretty much been a groupie for a heck of a lot of years. And I've really watched the race, and I've watched the progress, and watched, timing-wise, everything, as far as, you know, where the mushers are, when they stay, what they're doing. And with all of that studying, with the past and then running the last two races, to be in the position I was in Unalakleet, which was somewhere around where I finished, but to be that close to the pack. And then when I got to Shaktulik, I ended up staying there a little bit longer, and that was more of a group decision with the group of us mushers because of the way the storm was. I was happy with where I finished, but I have a whole lot of new plans for this year. I lease a team. I own some of my own dogs, but I lease a team from Dean Osmar, and Dean has always been a force in the training of sled dogs, going back to from before he won the race back in 1984, and one of my best friends, Paul Gebhardt. Paul trains just across the road from where we train down on in Kasila, and so we all train together. And I think with the, you know, with what I learned from them every year, and with my past experience, I'm you know, just like all of us are going to do in the race, but I am fortunate enough to have been able to lease a stellar team. And if any year I'm going to do well, this is going to be the year.
You say if any year is going to be the year, it's going to be this one. What, besides the, you know, the experience and things, you've got two under your belt now. What has changed for you besides that experience? Is it new dogs? Is it just that experience? What?
Well, it's a combination of the dogs and then my own self-confidence about the trail. My first year was the Southern Route, which we're going to do this year. And even though I plan on continuing the runner race for many years to come, the Southern Route, to me, the experience, even though the weather was stellar my first year, but the whole experience, I thought the Southern Route was psychologically and probably physically a little bit tougher than the Northern Route was. And again, that's only looking at those 2 years' experience, but we'll see this year. And then like I said, the confidence in my dog care, the confidence in the dogs that we have in the training regimen that we're doing. And then in further years, I have I've got a few puppies now, and in further years I'll be running my own team, and you know I'll be able to be one of those super proud mushers that raise their own dogs, and build their own team and run their own team, and so you know I know that that team's going to have to learn over a few years, and but of course I still might be leasing a few champions here and there to keep me up as far as I can towards the front.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Quite a few mushers do the same thing, whether they're leasing them or borrowing them or whatever they're doing. There's other teams' dogs spread through most of the teams, isn't there?
Oh yeah, definitely. And that's the ability to be able to do that and to recognize certain dogs. Like for instance, in the team that I have this year, I have a few dogs that were young dogs that ran on Anna Barrington's team last year. Excuse me, and her team also, she runs with me out of Dean Osmar's lot. And so these dogs are 3 years old. And they ran the race with Anna last year, and they're just incredible dogs. I mean, strength, size, and just everything, ability as far as speed. And they're somewhat the term that I've heard Paul Gebhardt use about certain dogs is, you know, they're bomb-proof. They're just, their attitude is always good. Their physical, I mean, how their stamina is always good, and they eat well, and so having that combination, I'm really excited.
You know, you mentioned Paul Gebhardt and the Osmar clan down there. I'm pretty good friends, and one of my mentors is Dave Shear. He hails from that area from back then, down there in the Kasilof area. How does that prepare you guys for running down on the peninsula versus, you know, up here where I live in Willow and, of course, Fairbanks, Two Rivers, Tok, all those areas? It's a little bit different climate than the rest of Alaska, isn't it?
Well, it is, but the last few years and over the last 12 years of running down there, you know, we've seen conditions where we've had to spend a lot of time up north. And so normally early season, we go up to like Lake Louise and run out of Wolverine Lodge. And you know, there we're getting the expanse of running around along the sides of the lake until it's froze over. But we can put some good mileage on. But the last few years, we've been able to run right out of both Dean and Paul's yards. And Paul does a trail behind his place back there where, surprisingly enough, in a small area, we can put 48 miles on easily and only do the same trail on the straight in trail coming back in. So it doesn't get boring with the dogs. But then we have the ability, too, to jump across the road and go up into the Caribou Hills. Because when we get into the Caribou Hills, I mean, there's some pretty challenging ups and downs in that, and the train we're running through. So I really like it as a training ground. I personally dream of having some property, you know, up in the valley where I could get to it faster from work, and I hope to soon have some property up there to be able to run and actually hit the Iditarod Trail and do some miles that way. But in the meantime, hills, I really like it down in the Kasilof.
You know, let's talk a little bit about work. You know, during this show, we talk to all different walks of life, everybody from Ramey Smith and his log-building days, and, you know, a lot of the guys are doing fishing during the off-season, you know, commercial fishing and that sort of thing. But you've got one of the most interesting jobs on the Iditarod Trail. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as a funeral director, in Alaska, we hold two licenses. I'm both a funeral director and an embalmer. But in Minnesota and other places, the term for that is a mortician. I explain to people, I use the old term, and I explain that I'm an undertaker. And in what we do as a funeral director, I mean, I've had people in all walks of life, including, you know, in checkpoints talking about different things, and all of a sudden what I do for a living comes up. And I've had some reactions that tend to go to the EU kind of a reaction. But the thing about what we do is it's an extremely satisfying job. And I found, looking back on my 51 years, that I've always been a bit of a satisfaction freak, whether it be mowing the yard or whatever I'm doing. I like to do things well and look back on a job well done. Well, as a funeral director, we help people, and in essence, like I tell our employees, what we try to do is make people comfortable enough, as comfortable as we can, on the worst day of their life.
Right, right.
And just to be myself, to you know, not be the old hand-wringing undertaker, and, you know, I don't wish doom and gloom on anyone, but the end of the trail, all of us are going to get there at some point. And since Iditarod, I've talked about that with a lot of groups, about, as a funeral director, that people don't think about their own eventual end, the end of the trail. And I talk to people about that I think of death more often than the average bear. And daily I'm reminded of my own mortality. And I think as a funeral director, I have gotten to know people after their death. I'm at the funeral, and I'm listening to the story of their life. And I've always been fascinated by the toughness of those that have lived before us. And I've said many times that I believe, and a lot of this comes from being a funeral director, but some might be from maybe a little wisdom through the years, but I really believe that we as humans are getting weaker. And this using a generality, but we're getting weaker physically and psychologically every generation. And so you look back at the people that did the gold rush, the people that you know, Johnny Horton, they crossed the Yukon River and found their bonanza gold. And when you think of those people and how they did what they did, you know, people, the old-timers from the Palmer and Wasilla and Anchorage area, that when they went hunting, they're carrying frying pans. You know, they're carrying frying pans that weigh as much as my whole cook kit these days. And I wanted to prove to myself that you know, the glory days aren't over just because I'm 45, 50 years old, and that there's more things to be able to pursue and to do. And that's why I thought, with my interest in mushing, to try for the Iditarod. You know, if I can do that. And now that I've done the Iditarod twice, the competition is more with myself than with the other mushers. You know, I'm running that race with them, and I'm in awe of most of these people that have, I mean, all of the people that have run the race before me and with me. And I just want to do better every year and kind of beat myself every year. And in the meantime, maybe I'll make up a few positions.
You know, Scott, you do great work. Scott Jansen is our guest tonight on Mushing Radio. I want to talk a little bit about that good work that you're doing, not only on the trail, but in your life. You know, you provide a lot for a lot of folks, and you make people's lives better. And one story I want to mention, first and foremost, is one of the things that you did this year at the first of the Yukon checkpoint. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it turned out that at the mushers meeting, it turned out that there for whatever reason, didn't happen to be a prize for the first of the Yukon this year. And so after a little bit of discussion, some of the veteran mushers had brought up a couple of points, and I just decided, you know, doggone, this would be a good thing to do for the rest of the mushers. Granted, I would really love to have won it myself. I raised my hand, and Mark Nordman called on me, and I volunteered to donate the $3,000 to the musher that got to the Yukon first. And I'm happy to say that was Mitch Seavey. And when I gave that to Mitch up at the banquet in Nome, I had it in a little teeny cherry casket that is exactly like a regular casket. And I had it in $20 bills sequential that added up to $3,000.
Wow. Very cool. Congratulations on that. I so much commend you for that great work. And you do a lot of great deeds like that. But one of the topics you want to mention, Scott, we were talking off air, is about pet and human CPR. I know that's a big talking point for you at a lot of places that you speak at. But you also have a lot of firsthand experience, in particular on this year's Iditarod.
Well, yeah, I do. And there's actually the videos on YouTube under, you can go into Mushin Mortician or Mouth to Snout Resuscitation. Anyway, I was running the team, and they were all running strong, and we left Rainy Pass, and as we left Rainy Pass going up, everybody's running and charging along strong, and on my team last year, my oldest dogs happened to be four of the dogs that I own personally and two others on the team. And they were all super strong dogs. And as most people listening to this know, but if you don't know, our dogs go through some pretty extensive, some very extensive medical testing. EKGs, blood tests, everything. They test the dogs. They make sure that dogs are physically fit and ready to be able to take off on this journey. And so all of my dogs, of course, were in extremely good health. And away we went. We came over the top of Rainy Pass. As you've probably heard, that when you come over Rainy Pass, your dogs pretty much disappear two at a time as you go over the hill. And as I came down that, it was, I don't know what time at night, but it was after midnight, and it was snow. The snow was blowing hard. And as I came over and I started coming down through the trenches, I was at a spot where it was wide enough, and Martin Boozer had just passed me, and he went down and disappeared down the trail. You know, his team was looking great. My team was looking great. And all of a sudden, about Martin's headlamp disappeared around over the one next bend, all of a sudden, I'm staring at the dogs, and my dog, Marshall, who, I mean, all of my dogs are I love so much, but Marshall, when my beard went gray, Marshall's face turned gray, and, you know, I always joked around about the fact that he and I were growing old together, but a big, strong dog, and Marshall's pulling, and he's, you know, tug line tight as a guitar string, and all of a sudden, he dropped.
Wow.
And most of us that mush know that every once in a while, especially when young dogs, you know, they'll try to sit down, they'll do whatever. And some dogs will just get to the point where they'll just lay down. Boom, you got to stop right now. Well, Marshall isn't that kind of dog, ever. I mean, Marshall doesn't falter. He's always been a big stud. And so along we're going, and boom, he fell down. So I stopped immediately. Now, I'm in fresh, deep snow. I stopped, and I ran up to Marshall, and he was ahead of the wheel position on the left side of the gang line. And I ran up to him and I picked him up by his harness and said, "Come on, bud, jump up." And I lifted him up by his harness. And when I did, he fell over again. And when he fell over this time, he fell with his back towards the gang line. So his face was looking towards me. And his eyes showed that he was dead. I mean, there was absolutely no sign of life. And when you see a dead animal, it's quite apparent by the look, the glazed look on their eyes. And I dropped to my knees right away and immediately started CPR. Now, when he fell, laying side like that, completely unconscious, no heartbeat, respiration. So I tucked his tongue back into his mouth so that I could get firm closure of his mouth, which you need to do to establish that air passage. And I did that, and I just held his mouth shut with my left hand, and I put my mouth completely over his nose. The first thing I did was I sucked inward, and this I did all super quickly when I dropped down, but I sucked inwards because we were running through the trenches. The snow at that time was a couple feet deep, at least on the sides of the trail, and all of the dogs will have a tendency to dip into the snow. And my first thought was that he had dipped and jammed his nose full of snow and suffocated. And so I sucked back inwards, and I spat out whatever I got, and I started to breathe into his nose. And at the same time, I was gently doing a heart massage, and not necessarily in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but I was doing a steady rhythmic heart massage with him, but then running my arms kind of in a circle back down over his ribs and up. And when I'd get up is when I'd compress, and then I'd rub down over. And I was rubbing down over twofold. I wanted to make sure that the air that I was pushing into him was going into his lungs and not diverting and going straight into his belly. And the same thing can happen with a human. And that's the reason to get the head and the neck back and the top of the head bent back so that the airway passage is open to go to the lungs. And after doing that with Marshall for, I mean, I swear it seemed like an hour, but it couldn't have been more than 10 minutes. And I was, I was sobbing, and I looked up at the sky, and the snow was coming down through my headlamp, and I hope I never forget it. But I looked up at the sky, and I just said, "Please, God, please let him come back." And I looked down at Marshall, and I can still picture my tears dripping off my nose down onto his snout. And I said something to the effect of, "Please, dude, please come back." And I breathed into his nose again, and halfway through that breath, and the only time I'd really paused was for that little time, and halfway through that next breath, he literally just coughed right back out. and his eyes remained closed, and I kept rubbing him, but he was starting to breathe, and he breathed, you know, very roughly at first, and after a few more minutes, he started breathing rhythmically, and all of a sudden, he opened up his eyes, and he still didn't lift his head up, but he opened up his eyes, and I swear he looked at me like, wow, Dad, what am I doing back here, you know?
Huh.
And at the time, I've got a 7-year-old godson who is more like my son. And Jacob is going to be a musher someday. When I'm 65, he'll be 18. We'll be on the trail together. And we've been watching the show All Dogs Go to Heaven. And it's a cartoon show. And in that show, this dog, of course, dies, goes to heaven, and God makes the decision that he comes back down. So, I mean, it was extremely heavy on the point of I love Marshall so much, and that he came back, and the way the night was, and the entire experience. And that's when then I loaded Marshall onto my sled. I have these great big beaver mittens and a beaver hat that my friend Rick Jones made for me. And I laid that down in my sled, and Marshall's about, you know, 66 pounds at that time, and I got him in the sled, and I took off down, and as I'm going down, and now this is going down the Dalzell Gorge, where you're coming down, and you're getting into the spot where, you know, the river's right there, and you're winding through it, and you got the rock banks on one side and trees all over, and it is just way too much excitement, and I looked down, and Marshall had closed his eyes. And I thought the worst, and Robert, you know from standing on a sled, I leaned down holding on to the right hand of the handle of the sled, and as I leaned down with my left hand to rub Marshall to see if he was okay, just that change in my weight on the sled turned the sled a little bit to the right side of the trail. And just as I petted Marshall and he opened up his eyes and I could see he was okay, instantly at that time, my brake caught a stump that was sticking up in the trail. And when it caught that stump, that's what sheared my runner right at the front, right where the runner on the right meets the snow. And so as I took off going down the rest of the Dalzell Gorge, I basically had, you know, half a brake, if that, and the one runner on the right side kept wanting to disappear off the back. So it was quite a feeling just to get to Roan and then to leave Roan and be like, woo-hoo, I fixed my runner. And then, you know, the highs and lows of life.
Sure.
You know, I was like, woo-hoo, I can do anything. Bam! And then I hit a stump and destroy my sled. And so the excitement just kept coming on and on through the whole race.
You know what, Scott? Awesome stories, and I hate to cut you off. We have about 3 minutes left, but man, we've done a lot of interviews on this show, and I don't know if we've had this many stories. Good radio. I do appreciate it. How is Marshall doing now, if he's still with us?
Actually, he's still with us. He is the best house dog in the whole wide world, and I would like to say if anybody out there ever wants to adopt an older dog that still has a lot of good years in him, a retired sled dog is the dog to have. And they walk on a leash great because they never want to be tight on their neckline on the gang line, and they're loyal. So Marshall is super healthy. I've got little puppies up here 4 and 5 months old, and Marshall's talking them, and we still have Lightning and Harley and Davidson that live here at the house. So he's got a lot of company, even though he's not training for any running anymore.
Very cool. Awesome stuff, Scott. And you are running this year, 2013 Iditarod?
Oh yeah, I'll be running for a long time.
Very cool. We'll definitely keep in touch for sure. Anything you want to mention? And I know you have some websites and stuff. Go ahead and plug that if you want.
Okay. Well, actually, there's a couple ways to be able to watch the training that I do for the race, and then our daughter posts information throughout the Iditarod, and everybody throughout Iditarod knows, of course, of Iditarod.com, where the most information you can get. But the stuff about the Mush and Mortician is available through my funeral home website, which is www.jansenfuneralhomes.com, or simply go into www.mushinmortician.com, and that's mushin without the G, mushinmortician.com.
And I'll make sure to post those on our page as well, and I'll send you over some links and things to this show too, okay?
Well, that'd be great, and I'm also, my daughter does a big thing on Facebook, so I know there's a lot of Facebook folks out there, so if they get a chance, go on and like the Mush and Mortician.
Will do. We'll definitely make sure all those links get posted. Scott, it was my pleasure. Good luck with training, and we'll keep in touch, all right?
All right. Thank you very much, Robert. Have a great evening.
You too. Take care. That was Scott Jansen calling in, the Mushin Mortician. Check him out on Facebook and on his websites as well. Make sure we post some links to that. Next week we have Ali Zirkle on Mushin Radio. Until then, we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.